Next talk is by Marco Micheli of Palermo, measuring the post-shock temperatures of heavy ions in supernova 1987A.
Hi, thank you. Okay, so I'm gonna present the measure of the ion temperature in the post-shock plasma of 87A. This is a work that relies on the combination of X-ray data analysis and detailed dynamic simulation. And here you can see a list of the people involved in this project. I also have to thank Damiano for the nice introduction on collisionless shocks, so I will go very fast in this slide. The main idea is studying how a collisionless shock propagates in a medium where different particle species with different masses are present, and in particular checking whether somehow the different particles reach a temperature equilibrium, so we have a unique post-shock temperature, which would be a function of the mean particle mass, or if each particle species is heated at a different temperature depending on its mass. And okay, let me say that first of all, we know that electrons and protons are heated at different temperature in supernova remnants. This is a very famous plot by Gavamian and collaborator that shows that the electron to proton temperature ratio is always lower than one. However, it is much higher than the corresponding mass ratio. And the basic idea is that the electron temperature does not depend on the shock velocity, while the proton temperature scale as the square of the shock velocity under the canonical relation. And this is because the electrons and protons are heated with different processes. So if we want to study the mass dependence of the post-shock temperature, we need to look at particles which are heated with the same mechanism, like protons and ions. This is something that has been done by looking at the supernova remnants and also by looking at the interplanetary shock where one can perform some in situ measurement. And the results are somehow in tension because we have that the oxygen to proton temperature ratio has been found to be lower than the corresponding mass ratio in 1006. In interplanetary shocks, typically the temperature ratio is instead higher than the mass ratio. And indeed, some other heating mechanisms have been invoked recently to explain this strange behavior. Well, there is this recent paper by Raymond and collaborator that shows that for this range of masses, ranging from helium up to nitrogen, the ion to proton temperature ratio scales with the mass. So in order to discriminate among these three different possibilities, we need to look at heavy ions. So we enlarge the range in this mass ratio axis. And to do this, we need to go to the X-ray band. There is a measurement of the oxygen temperature performed with X-rays for this knot here, which is an ejecta knot in Centeno 6. This is a measure that has been done with RGS with XMM Newton. And the broadening of the line clearly shows that the oxygen temperature is extremely high, is of the order of 300 keV, which means that is two orders of magnitude higher than the electron temperature. And so this proves that ions can be heated up to very high temperature in supernova remnant shocks. But we want to move further and to study in detail the actual relationship between mass and temperature. And to do this, we looked at the huge data sets of X-ray observations that are available for 87A, which has been continuously monitored with both Chandra and XMM Newton. Here I show you a few light curves of 87A at different ages. Here you can see the evolution of the morphology in X-rays obtained with Chandra, showing how the source becomes brighter and larger. And we know that this reflects the interaction of the outer ejecta and of the forward shock with an H2 region, which produce hard X-ray emission, and a denser ring, which hosts even denser knots, which produce soft X-ray emission. Now, traditionally, these observations have been analyzed one by one by adopting ad hoc models, phenomenological models. Now, we changed the approach and we decided to adopt a single model, a physical model, to describe at the same time all the observations altogether. To do this, we developed a hydrodynamic simulation following the evolution of 87A from the supernova phase up to the age of 50 years, so up to 2036-37. And we set up our model by considering the results of the data analysis, but then we synthesized from the hydrodynamic model observables that we directly compared against the actual data. in order to get the fine tuning of the model, but also to get a physical insight on the origin of the X-ray emission. And so this is just a brief slide showing the parameters of the simulations. I will skip the details because Salvatore Orlando will discuss in detail this modeling and its development in his talk on Friday. Let me also advise this poster by Fabrizio Bocchino, where you can experience a virtual reality tour of 87A. And, but let me focus on the synthesis of the observable, because it is crucial. What we did is that we synthesized from the aerodynamic model the X-ray data by including many important effects. For example, we included non-equilibrium of ionization. We also included the difference in the electron and proton temperature. We assumed the electrons to be always heated at 0.3 keV, regardless of the shock velocity, as in the Gavamian model. And then we followed the Coulomb collisions between electrons and protons in the post-shock flows. Then we, of course, included interstellar absorption and the instrumental response of XMM Newton and Chandra. So this allows us to synthesize the actual data. For example, we can synthesize fluxes. And these curves show you the evolution of the flux as a function of time for the soft X-rays and for the hard X-rays. And you can see that we can explain very well the evolution observed. We can also synthesize images. These are maps synthesized from our model in 2007 and 2011 compared with the actual Chandra observation. These have been obtained by degrading the resolution to the Chandra resolution. And as you can see, we can explain both the morphology, the size, and the brightness of the source. We can also do other quantitative estimates. For example, we can measure the electron-to-proton temperature ratio at the reverse shock of 87A. This is something that has been measured by Franz and collaborator, who found this range of temperature from the data analysis. And in our simulation, we predict a value that is in very good agreement with their estimates. So this proves that the model is very reliable, but we can even get a higher level of diagnostics by synthesizing spectra. These are CCD spectra. In particular, these are EPIC, XMM Newton EPIC spectra, synthesized for 2001 and for 2013, compared with the actual spectra, which are the black crosses here. As you can see, the spectra fits very well the observation. Let me point out that this is not a fittings. I mean, this is just the outcome of the simulation without any ad hoc adjustment. But with the single aerodynamic model, we can describe both the spectra in 2001, where the emission is dominated by the shock at H2 region, here in blue, and in 2013, where instead the emission is dominated by the shock at the ring. So the same model can explain this evolution of the system in a self-consistent way. But if we want to measure the ion temperature, we need to go to high-resolution spectroscopy, because we need to measure the line width. And to do this, we synthesized the synthetic spectra, the Chandra energy transmission grating spectra, by including all the possible sources of line broadening, namely the fact that there is a bulk motion of the plasma, which produces a bulk Doppler broadening, the fact that the source is extended, because 87A is resolved by Chandra, so there is a broadening associated with the size of the source, and then the thermal broadening. This is somehow complicated because we are observing 87A from this angle. This is the line of sight. This is the ring, which is tilted more or less of 45 degrees. And this is the dispersion axis of the actual observations. So what we get is that since the ring is expanding, we have that the northern part of the ring, what we see here at north, will be blue shifted, while the southern part of the ring will be red shifted. Now, this means that if we look in the plus one order, where we disperse the light in this direction, the spatial extension of the source and the Doppler motion will work in opposite direction. And this will make the line stretched somehow. While if we look in the minus square order, the two effects sum up, because what is southernmost will be even more redshifted. And this will produce a larger width for the lines. Now, since the thermal broadening is the same in the two orders, its relative contribution will be the highest here in the plus one order. So to measure it, we synthesize the plus one mag spectra obtained with the Chandra energy transmission grating. in two different epochs, 2007 and 2011, corresponding to two deep observations that have been performed. And this is what we get. This is the comparison between the model in red and the data points in black. As you can see, we have a very nice agreement. Again, this is not the fitting. This is just the outcome of the simulation, 2007 and 2011. And here I show you some close-up view of selected spectral ranges just to show you that the agreement is very nice. Now we want to focus on the line broadening. So let's take this line as an example. This is iron 17. What we do when we synthesize spectra is that we turn on and off the thermal broadening from our synthetic spectra. So these are the data points, the black points here. And the blue line shows how the line would look like without thermal broadening. So this is just the broadening associated with the Doppler motion and the spatial extension of the source. As you can see, these clearly underestimate the actual width of the line. If we turn on the thermal broadening and we assume that the iron temperature is proportional to its mass, what we get is the red curve here. That is, you can see, fits very well the data points. By the way, the green line is just a phenomenological fit, while the red line is the physical fit. As you can see, this is a very nice agreement. So we can repeat this exercise for several lines. Here are a few examples where I show you here the line broadening as a function of energy for different lines. And you can see in black what we measure from the data, and in blue what we get from Doppler shift and spatial extension of the source. So this difference, the difference between what we observe and what we would get because of Doppler motion and of the extension of the source, will give us a measure of the temperature. And this is something that we can do for 2007, for 2011. As you can see, if we don't include thermal broadening, we always underestimate the line width. So from this difference, we can infer the contribution of thermal broadening, and then we can infer the ion lines. So we can do this calculation for different lines, for different epochs. We then average all things together, and this is the final results that we get. This is a plot showing the ion to proton temperature ratio as a function of the atomic weight. Here are protons, one. And as you can see, the temperature increases with the mass linearly. If we do a simple linear regression to these 5 points, what we get is a coefficient which is consistent with being one. So this supports the fact, and it is indeed in very nice agreement with what Damiano showed before, that the temperature increases linearly with the atomic weight. And we also repeated this exercise for the new deep observations of 87A that have been performed in March last year. And this is what we get. This is, the again, data points in black and model in red. As you can see, there is a very nice agreement between models and observation. This is quite remarkable because the simulations were performed in 2014. So we were somehow able to predict the evolution of the spectrum quite well. Unfortunately, the error bars are a little bit higher. The statistics are not that good, but we still can repeat our measurement. And what we get is, again, that we confirm the mass proportional trend also for the new observation. So this is another confirmation of this. And okay, just the conclusion. What we did is that we decided to adopt a single physical model, a hydrodynamic model, to describe all the set of observations performed in the X-rays for 87A. And we found that we were able to fine-tune this model in order to reproduce the evolution of the fluxes of the spectra and of the morphology of the source very well. This gives us the confirmation that we are describing very well the expansion of the source because we can follow its expansion in time. So this allows us to extract information on the real Doppler contribution of the Doppler broadening. And then by comparing this contribution with that observed, with the line we observed, from this difference, we were able to measure the temperature of the ions and then to derive the relationship between post-shock temperature and mass for a very large range of masses going up to the iron mass. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco, especially for staying on time. Questions? While y'all are thinking about your questions, I have one. You mentioned something about about how the electrons were the electrons are initially heated, did you say, a little bit?
Yes. Electrons are always heated at 0.3 keV.
Oh, okay. So you just,
and then okay. Ions, the temperature depending on the shock velocity, and then we have Coulomb collisions in the post-shock flow, and we follow the evolution of temperature. This is crucial to synthesize the spectra.
Okay, so the amount of electron heating is independent of the shock speed?
Yes.
I see, okay.
Very nice. Just one comment on the agreement with the scaling with the atomic mass. This is actually seen in simulation only if there is some turbulence, which may be due to the particle acceleration or not. So if we do a simulation of an oblique shock, where then actually heavy elements are not injected and they don't thermalize to the same temperature, so it probably means that so it's a non-trivial result in the sense that it suggests that there is some turbulence.
Pre-existing turbulence, yes.
Yeah.
Which is likely considering the environment of 87A, which is very chaotic somehow.
So, very nice result. This is beautiful work. Could you go back to the plot where you have the width with thermal broadening, without thermal broadening? So I think this is kind of the one more back where you have the keep going back one more. There you go, that one, yeah, okay. So I'm looking at the blue curve and I'm looking at the red curve. And, you know, not doing this modeling, it's hard for me to know. I mean, could you possibly change your assumptions of the geometry and the bulk velocities and explain all of the broadening without the thermal broadening? Or can you give us any confidence that there's just no way you can do that? So
we tried by changing a little bit the size of, assuming that we made some mistake in the distance estimation, so something like that, or by changing a little bit the tilting of the axis, but we never are able to explain the actual broadening without the thermal broadening. Yeah.
Any more questions? One more question? Klaus.
When you calculate the X-ray light curve and spectra, you have to assume something about the geometry of the ring and the distribution and structure of these hot spots, and also the distribution outside of the ring. So what do you assume?
Yes, this is... okay, so I can just discuss a little bit the setup of the simulation. Here it is. Sorry. Okay, so here what we have is that we have this hourglass-shaped H2 region, which has a density of about 100 particles per cubic centimeter, which is in agreement with observations. And then we have the ring with randomly distributed clamps. Again, both the density of the ring and the density of the clamps comes from data analysis, especially in the optical band. And what is interesting is that in our simulation, considering the size of the ring and its width, we predicted that the shock would have reached the outer border of the ring in 2017, and it did it, indeed. It went up from the ring in 2017. It's confirmed by both radio, optical, and X-ray observation. So this is a very good confirmation that we are describing the environment quite carefully.
But I guess, I mean, we are not really resolving these hot spots, and so it's depending on...
We can see
whether
them
you get in tangential shocks or head-on shocks and things like that would
we can
the temperature.
We can see these clamps in the optical band. Somehow they are quite visible. They were visible when the supernova exploded. Somehow, we tried different configurations with different sizes and different number of the clamps. And in the end, we found that with this configuration, we can explain the light curve. Because if you change the position, if you change the size, the spectrum will change, and so will the light curve. So if you want to reproduce the light curve, for example, this is the part where the shock reaches the ring. And so you need to place the clamps in a given way to have a given mass for the clamps and a given density. And what is nice is that what we found to best reproduce that is what is in agreement with that analysis, independent data analysis. So.
Okay, I think we have to move forward. Thank you again.